Hello all, it's your boy the Iron Podcaster, here to introduce another member of the White Scarvengers. Now that we've gone completely off the original path of having Airsat's MCU cast, it is my great pleasure to introduce the newest member. His secret identity is a wild-mannered ferret, but to the rest of the team, he is known as the purring planeswalker, the White Tiger. This is White Scarves Team Up. Hello again, dear listeners, and welcome to a new White Scarves Team Up. We're so happy to have yet another one of the Magnificent Seven on with us. Toby and I would like to introduce Matt Wardle.
Hello, hello. How is everybody?
Just as a brief overview, you would know Matt best from playing Jeremy Pines in several of the books in the New Century oeuvre. He is also known for playing Oberon, the lovable Akka in The Princess Thieves, and going forward as well. He has voiced a number of other characters along the way, most of which are just supporting characters, but we'll get into all of that eventually. He's been a mainstay of this for a very long time. We're so happy to finally get him on the horn, because we know that you've got a lot of stuff going on in your life. First question. We've so far heard from Theo, who became a cast member after being an Ascended fan, and Loretta, who not only does dramatic work outside of New Century, but is a consummate maker of silly voices. I'm very curious to hearing your backstory of how you were originally picked for the cast, and if acting or voice acting is something you were also pursuing, either before or after.
Oh, sure. Quite a few years now, a friend of mine, Victoria, pointed me towards Alex, who was looking to do, I think it was an audio dramatization of Batman. I think it was Hush.
This was the infamous Hush that...
Yes.
Does that even exist now, or is it just a planned thing?
I don't think it ever came to fruition, if I remember right.
People tend to be most familiar with Alex's podcast-related creations. The days of Digital Cowboys, Gonzo, Drift, and all the spin-off tangents he did with that. What's come up a couple of times now in interviews with cast members was Alex's desire to do creative performances of some of his favorite Batman stuff. Unfortunately, much of that is now lost to time. His old audio drama of The Killing Joke got hit by YouTube, and only exists on somebody else's channel, uncaught because of its non-English origins. Batman Breakdown is still available on YouTube, and is worth a listen to. It remains unscathed, because it's basically an original work. But Hush never even got out the door, and when I asked Alex about it, the short answer is that he shelved it after a lot of negative reactions from crappy Batman fans. I'm sorry for Alex because of shitty people being shitty. But these earlier works are what brought Alex into contact with this team of glorious voice acting geeks, something I and many fans of New Century are grateful for. Batman is all well and good, but this feels like the story Alex was meant to tell. Something far more intriguing and engaging, and unburdened by the weight of other stories and a toxic existing fan base.
And what I did is I auditioned for Scarecrow, because even though I have kind of a, I don't know, every man kind of, I some people say deeper. It only goes deeper when I do it like that. But my normal everyday voice is like this. And I like villainous stuff.
Oh,
I read it.
Well, that's
in,
interesting.
Yeah. Oh, I love villains. Villains are by far my favorite. But I read it in a very monotone, almost metronomical part where he goes, I think it was, you know, hush little baby, don't say a word. And I just did it like, hush little baby. I mean, I can't even remember it because I did it kind of like more sinister. And I really have to kind of get back in that mindset. And I just went through the whole thing and sent that off. And I think Alex responded with bloody hell. That was just creepy as all get out. I'm like, perfect. That's exactly what I was going for.
I was just going to say, I could imagine he would respond to this audio file he was received from a man over the internet. I was like, wow, this was a terrific audition. And you respond with audition?
Yeah, exactly. Video games. And from there, I think is when the whole New Century universe started coming together. And he asked me if I'd be interested. And I'm like, oh, gosh, sure. I'd never been a formal actor, as it were. And I did want to get into voice acting as it was. And I took some classes, you know, as an adult. And, you know, just for the record, I just turned 48 last month. Part of the way that, you know, my life is scheduled in terms of, you know, you can use what you want here. My partner is disabled, so I take care of her generally, you know, a good amount. You know, I have a teenage son, you know, full-time job, you know, so I kind of I bounce from thing to thing. So while I would love to do it and do it more, part of the problem also is that I have a really good job. So you know, it's like, well, do I, you know, go, well, I don't really need this paycheck versus, you know, maybe I can do it in my spare time. Mm. So I'm still trying to find a good balance between, you know, how to do more of it, you know, as well as, you know, still maintaining, you know, a level of, you know, what we're used to around here to be able to, you know, live day to day.
Well, we're obviously biased because, you know, we started a whole podcast over this, and I say this to everyone who comes on board, and it's all true. I've yet to say, oh, heard your work, it was okay. We think we love all the characters, well, not all the characters, because as you implied earlier, you enjoy the villains, and we'll, don't worry, we will get to that. But, It's the sort of thing where we love Jeremy and Oberon, and so we want to hear more of them because you bring them to life. But I think I would speak for both of us when I say the sort of well-being of the people involved in this comes first and foremost before anything else. So no pressure.
Oh, no worries. Yeah, I love doing it, and I think finally, it's been on and off for the past couple of years for me, just in general, and actually, you know, simply because of, you know, the well-being, you know, something else that Jin, who is my partner, like the drink, what Jin and I do is we also do a lot of costume and cosplay work, which is also causes us a lot of, I would say, stress. It's stress because we've done. This is the first year that Jin and I have not traveled anywhere for a convention since 2008.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm actually on vacation this week. I've got nowhere to go, nothing pressing to do, and, you know, with general quarantine going on, I honestly kind of don't know what to do with myself for an entire week, going, wow, this is great. You know, so it's affording me a bit more of, you know, good downtime to kind of recover, because honestly, I think out of everything that I've done, even though I do like villains, I think Oberon by far was my favorite, because in a lot of ways, he and I share a lot of the same qualities. And I think that reflected in how I portrayed him and how he came across, you know, from the points where he's angry. If you remember the part where he's like, oh, you're going to hear my story now, you know, because it's goddamn hard to kill a drake, you know, it's that's kind of me when I get angry, but it's also, you know, me when I get sad, you know, when at the end, when he's like, you know, and it's just time for me to go. That's all me and how it comes forward. So, yeah, Oberon really actually holds an incredibly, you know, special place in my heart for everything that he is. So,
that is actually, you've jumped ahead just very slightly to one of our early questions.
Oh, see, we can go back to it. Yeah, sure.
Well, I would be very interested in hearing you expound a little bit more on why it is your experience with Oberon is primarily that you're just drawing on a very personal place when you emote for him. But Oh, God. Well, actually, hold on a second. You may have just answered part of that question without directly intending to, because if Oberon is caring for what is essentially his disabled brother, and you have to be a caretaker for your partner, then there is a... Oh, there's a lot of synchronicity right there.
Yep.
Oh, dear.
You can include what you want. I mean, Jin has severe narcolepsy. So there are times, you know, like I'll walk into the kitchen, you know, to get something. Like, hey, Jin, do you want some? And I'll come back in, and oh, you're face down on the couch. Okay, yeah. Or you know, if we're trying to make things, you know, I've come home from work, you know, from the office, you know, when I used to have to go to the office, you know, I come in and like she's face down on the desk, hands on the sewing machine. I'm like, oh, that's not good, you know, or you know, and. Some cases, you know, I've had to come home because she has sleep paralysis, which I don't know. Do you know much about it?
I know of it existing, and I've heard, I think it was at one point on one of the Jimquisitions, Laura Kate Dale and Jim Sterling were talking about their brief experiences with it, but it doesn't seem like it's a natural thing for them. It's just something that came up recently due to health problems.
Oh, okay. I know both of those names. With sleep paralysis, I mean, literally imagine you wake up, your eyes pop open, and you can't move. And with Jin, generally, it, you know, it loosens up from, you know, the neck down to the shoulders, down, you know, to the waist, to the legs, you know, I mean, so there have been times where, you know, she's kind of had to turtle herself out of bed and, you know, kind of, well, I need to go to the bathroom, so I'll just have to, you know, combat crawl across, you know, or, you know, she would text me at the office, and I've gotten good at reading narcolepsy / sleep text. I'm going, okay, you look at it and go, that's just garbled. I'm like, no, that means, okay, I'm having sleep paralysis, bad day. You know, I'm like, all right, I'll come home and, you know, take care of you and work from home for the rest of the day. So, you know, so in those terms of disabilities, I mean, that there are times, you know, I've had to kind of pick her up and it's like, okay, well, let's get you to bed and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So hers are definitely a lot more physical ailments, but, you know, it's still, you know, it still takes a toll, you know, and when Scott's asked me, and when he was younger, you know, he and his mother, you know, his mother and I, you know, we live a few minutes apart. We're still good friends, but there are times, you know, he's asked me, you know, how come this or how come this? And it's like, okay, well, you know, if your mom gets sick or her husband gets sick, you know, the other one can go, oh, I'll go get you, you know, stuff from the pharmacy or whatnot. You know, if Jin gets sick, I go take care of it. But if daddy gets sick, daddy's like, well, daddy has to get in the car and, you know, go drag himself down to get some medicine or something like that. So, you know, sometimes, you know, I need that little cool down period, as it were. That comes into a lot of play where, you know, I've had to be a single dad. I've had to be a caretaker, you know, so that, you know, resonated, you know, directly with me going, I know how this feels. Yeah. You know, it's rough when you go, well, what comes first right now? You know, am I at a point where I'm okay enough to handle this and yet someone else? Or am I at the point where I'm like, I literally have to take this time for myself? And then you get that horrible guilt complex going, oh man, you know, how do I balance both mine and theirs when I know someone's depending on me for something? And that really comes through with Oberon, you know, taking care of his buddy and making sure that, you know, he's okay. And then making sure that people aren't mistreating or taking advantage of him, you know, and that really, damn, getting me a little choked up here. that really comes through in what he has to do. And then near the end where he's realizing that, I'm kind of going downhill. And that's also personal for me because, you know, like I said, I'm 48 now, and in my day, you know, in my younger days, I was an extremely active and generally, you know, higher level athlete. And, you know, when you rely on so much of that over time, and you're just like, okay, mid-30s, you know, I'm like, oh, your metabolism will slow down here. I'm like, ah, the hell it will. And it didn't yet. But boy, I tell you, I hit 38. And all of a sudden I'm like, oh, well, maybe a little, you know, mid 40s. I'm going, oh my gosh, you know, and then it's like, you know, all right, great. I went grocery shopping and dang, I'm tired. You know, I'm like, oh my God, what is going on here? You know, trying to keep up with that and realizing, yeah, you're starting to lose that edge. Yeah, you're not, you know, recovering as fast. I'm like, oh, you know, great. I have an itch on my arm, scratch it, you know, next day, how the hell did I get a bruise on my arm? What the hell is this nonsense? You know, and you know, when Oberon starts realizing, oh, geez, I'm starting to go downhill too. That really hit hard because, yeah, I mean, that's something that, you know, that I struggle with as, you know, a person in their late 40s, you know, looking over the horizon at 50 going, how the hell am I almost 50? You know, that doesn't make sense to me. Yeah. So that's where a lot of that comes from.
I have to say that you're making a really good case for how it is that Oberon synchronizes with you. And yet, as I'm listening to you talk, the thing that comes through most clearly is the same sort of frenetic energy that Jeremy uses so thoroughly in his excitement and experiences with the world. So it's an interesting sort of duality there.
Very, very much so. Jeremy exhibits a lot of other facets of my personality because I'm also severely ADHD.
Okay.
So that's, you know, that bounciness that I'll jump from topic to topic to topic, you know, or activity to activity also kind of, you know, bites me in the backside. That comes from, and there are times where I'll also hyper focus where it's like, I will think nothing of except what I'm doing. You know, it's like, okay, that's great. I'm sorry she's dead, but hey, can you tell me more about this? Yeah, I know she's dead right there. It's fine. She'll still be dead, you know. You know, but I need to talk to you right now about this. It's pretty cool, huh? You
know, there are pictures of windows.
Yeah, it's like, you know, and you're like, man, can you pull a modicum of tact out of here? You know, that'd be great. You know, it's like, oh God. You know, so yeah, that definitely pulls from different parts as well. And that's what I do enjoy about some of the characters. It's like, okay, just you can focus on a couple, two, three characteristics and really elaborate or not exacerbate, but not even elucidate. I can't think of the right word. Enhance, over-exaggerate those parts to really either, you know, connect or emote or elicit some sort of response from the audience. You know, so Jeremy, you know, over time definitely has changed, you know, I think from his initial introductions to what he is now.
I mean, it's obviously, I think we can talk about this because at this point I got myself
these interviews are fair game.
Well, yeah, but more importantly, the thing that I hadn't considered with some of those previous interviews is that most people were specifically waiting for the audio drama in order to talk about Uncivil Outlaw.
Right.
And so therefore I might be covering things which technically people could know if they'd read the book, but may not know if they were literally just waiting for it to be dramatized out. But Jeremy has had his specific moment in Uncivil Outlaw where we get to see how the events of Steamheart have dramatically affected him, and he in general just comes across as a lot more, not that he has PTSD specifically, but just world weary and just finding it so hard to parse everything, particularly when it seems like the relationships that are core to his work and the things that he loves about his position are literally falling apart around him. It's just kind of heartbreaking a little bit to see that moment dramatized out through word and through action.
Yeah, it's yeah, again, personally, it's great when you have personal context to it. And obviously my situation's nowhere like that. But again, you know, sometimes, yeah, it's almost like the syndrome you see. It's like, okay, first kid, everything has to be sterile, pristine. Second kid, third kid, you're like, all right, are you eating paint chips? Are you drinking Drano? No? good. You'll make it. You know, and you know, when you go through a lot of that, you're like, oh, all right, fine. I'll just roll with it. And at times you understand what's best for you versus the entire community versus the world at large. And you're like, okay, how important really is this? And sometimes we get lost in that self-importance and exuberance of youth, you know, going, all right, this is the way I'm going to do it. And, you know, damn the torpedoes, let's go. And then, you know, you kind of look back and go, ooh,
maybe that was a bad call.
Yeah, that was a bad call. And then you never really get that out of your head sometimes, trying to keep looking forward and realizing, okay, you know, if I keep looking backward, I might hit a tree. But you know, it's good to, you know, keep those experiences, you know, in mind, you know. And oh man, I remember dumb things I've done and said, you know. I mean, back as far as 9, 8, yeah. Like that was idiotic. Yeah.
Everyone has that thing they did when they were like 12 years old that will keep them up at night, even at, when you're 60 years old. You're just like, oh God, goodness gracious, what did I do then? Why did I say that?
Yeah.
I had a couple of those moments captured on videotape because home movies. So we got to experience them.
Oh, that's the cruelest thing to do to a child.
Yeah, thankfully that wasn't a big thing when I was a kid. Yeah, so, you know,
I mean, like, I can embarrass. I can embarrass myself all I want on this. You'll not see my face. You, like, it's only half as embarrassing.
Yeah, but yeah, it just Jeremy going, all right, what do I have to do here? You know, kind of things. It's like, all right, we'll just go with it. You know, I've got my things to do, but you know, it's not at that, you know, that peak where I'm so enraptured and ignorant of what's going on around me.
There's a reevaluation going on. One of my favorite defining character moments for him is when you see that early chapter of Steamheart that shows one of his experiences when he was younger, where he was going on this expedition with a friend of his,
and
he comes to a point where he sees that his friend is really asking and really hoping that they can turn back, and Jeremy really looks at it, and as driven as he is, he's not so self-involved that he says, no, it's fine, let's keep going, because the way that that story is heading and the nature of a lot of flashback narratives of a character we've already been introduced to is you think it's going to go in a tragic direction, that the worst will happen and it will be something they regret. But you actually see that and you go, this is something that he has in him and has always had in him, that as much as he wants to chase the horizon, he does have one foot behind him, that he is ready to take that step back if it's for someone else's benefit. I think that what we're seeing in Uncivil Outlaw and where his character may head from here is the development of that part of him, and the thing that, you know, you hate to see, but you is maybe that fire that pushes him forward is flickering a little bit, not going out, just
right,
being challenged.
Yeah.
Okay, so talked a lot about Oberon and Jeremy, but there are a couple of things that I am curious about and would like to cover before we move on.
Sure.
The thing that makes me wonder now, based on realizing this synchronicity with Oberon's experience with his brother, was that something that you had influence in shaping when Princess Thieves originally came out, or was it just that you had a chance to speak extensively about your personal life with Alex, and so therefore he decided to include that subplot as being part of Oberon as the individual character moments come up in the story?
I'd say more the latter. I think, you know, the character had already been, developed and fleshed out, and the path that he would take. But Alex and I have definitely had, some very, heart to heart conversations about, some of the things that I've struggled with personally. And would not surprise me if some of how he was put together was tweaked and altered a bit to fit that narrative, for myself. I'll admit this on the record. I've not always been the most, I'd say, timely and reliable person for Alex. And I'm sure I've driven him beyond mad, a few times, but I still even now struggle a little bit with performance anxiety when it comes to that, for some bizarre reason, I'll sit down and go, oh gosh, I got to get through this. But again, I've gotten through all that. And, now if you're hearing this, Alex, I'll be better, of bringing that all, forward and together. So Oberon, in that regards, I think he put together perfectly for me, which I greatly appreciate, because it did allow me to get a little bit of my own story out there, subconsciously, as it were, because I think everyone's got that in them to go, hey, I'm dealing with some things, but a lot of us don't really want to put it out there and go, hey, I'm really in trouble. A lot of the stigma about, mental health and issues of, don't cry, don't show your emotions, don't show your feelings, blah, 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 blah. It's weakness, in some regards. And I've always been an extremely emotional person. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's great, sometimes it's not. I mean, earlier on in my, professional career, there were a couple of conversations where, like, you got to kind of not wear your heart on your sleeve as much, I'm like, okay, fine, I get it. But being able to put that out there at times where you're like, I'm human, I'm struggling. And when you put it out there, you're always dealing with the feeling of, hey, I'm not doing this for sympathy. I'm not doing this for people to go, oh, are you okay? You're just looking for people to go, I get it. We're not all alone in that regards. And sometimes you see people like, oh, everything is perfect. And then they take you aside. They're like, look, everything is not perfect. And it's like, look, everything you see on Facebook and Instagram is great. But meanwhile, oh my God, it's like,
zoom in on the picture and see the panicked pupils.
Exactly. It's like, it's like, damn, it's okay to, put that out there and go, I'm a person, and it happens, and we don't always have to be, top of the mountain, top of the heap, and that's why, again, Oberon to me is great. That's I love him.
There's a lot of power as well for the fact that all of this comes from a character who is visually the biggest guy in the group and is a sort of stand-in for the orc, and that's kind of this, I'm struggling to think of the word in fiction when there's not a prototype, but the
trope.
The trope, yes, that's it. The trope of, the orc-like creature is they'll be brutish, they'll be just single-minded and very simple and direct. And I think for Oberon to be this sort of big physical character that he has so much going on there, and he will bring that out to the people he trusts, and there's an emotional complexity there, is rewarding to see. And it feels like, no matter who you are, no matter what people see of you when they take a glance at you, that there is a capacity to be like this, to share this. And in that one of those last scenes of Princess Thieves, when he shares some of the stuff that is most worrying him, and there is a group there that says, all right, listen, you're not going to go through this alone. That's, I always talk about how New Century just helps me, and moments like that and characters like Oberon are absolutely essential to that experience.
Doing that scene was pretty rough, getting in that space and going, you know, without me blatantly going, this is me right now, not over me, you know, and throwing it out there and just letting the emotion go that I'm hurting for all the things that, you know, people rely on me for. It's really hard to ask for that help when sometimes you're in a position like that, you know, because again, a lot of people are depending on you and you're trying to impart some independence on, you know, on people, you know, and it simply can go, you know, when, you know, my son was growing up, you know, he's from 11 to 12 to 14, you know, it's like, hey dad, you know, what's for lunch? I'm like, what do you want? You know? And he's like, what's for lunch? I'm like, go make something, you know, trying to teach them those sort of things. And, you know, as he's been getting older, he's like, okay, well, how do I cook this? How do I make this? And, you know, the simple things of, hey, I put away the dishes, or hey, I, you know, did these really simple menial tasks where he goes, but I didn't really help. I'm like, you have no idea how much you've helped. You know, that's 5-10 minutes that I don't have to go, all right, wait, what do I got to do now? And put this away and then make sure that's okay. You know, and things like that, when that's what your role has felt like for a long time. And in some ways, as you know, I was talking about, you know, we were both talking about this. Oberon in a very small way also kind of reminds me of Fezzik from Princess Bride. You know, hello lady, you know, it's like, hey, I'm here to help. And, you know, by the way, you know, let me bust down this door and okay, you can go now, you know. It's like, you know, just here for your souls. You know, it's like, all right, if I gotta do it, I'll do it. Fine. I'll scare the crap out of everybody. Happy now? You know, it's like,
they're both like pretty much the smartest people in the room, or at least like the people who seem like, okay, like you don't necessarily have to have all your shit together, but of all of us, you really are the person who has all their shit together.
Yeah. You know, every now and then it's also, you know, kind of like, oh gosh, I'm going to pull an old animation reference here if I can, you know, it's like, from Looney Tunes, you know, the giant bulldog and the tiny yappy chihuahua. It's like, hang on. Yes, I know you want to go. Just stop. You know, it's like, that's Oberon and Robin. It's like, stop. Just stop. Stop it. You know, it's like, you crazy little. You know,
oh my God. Robin is Scrappy Doo. Let me at him.
Yeah, it's like, come back here. You're going to get yourself hurt. Okay, all right. Don't say I didn't warn you. All right, fine, I'll come save you.
This is actually going to be incredibly useful fodder for, like, it's going to be months off now at this point, and even Alex is a little bit annoyed by this because it does take us a while for us to make our way through all of this. I'm already planning on limiting the Cartographer's Handbook, at least the initial episodes for it, down to two, one to cover the characters and one to cover the narrative aspects of Cartographer's Handbook, just so we can get to Tiger's Eye, because he's working on Panther Soul right now, and so therefore could use some of the extra boost as well as some of the humor value in that particular story. But Princess Thieves is obviously the funniest of all of the New Century oeuvre, and yet the thing that I'm thinking about most as I was listening to you talk about wearing your heart on your sleeve or just closing yourself off in order to protect yourself, it makes me think of that conversation, that really sort of one-sided conversation between Oberon and Mortimer, where he is just completely done and he has nothing left, and she's coming in looking for emotional work that he just utterly refuses to provide.
Yeah.
Like, you've been a problem this whole time, lady. You're feeling guilty now. I'm not going to help you with that. You're just going to have to sit there and work your way through it yourself. You're not even worth the effort of punching.
And Mortimer is so based on like the counterattack, both in like her fighting and just her banter with people, is she will have like the perfect retort to things. And it's like, come on, say something so I can be snippy back at you.
Yeah.
This is no fun. Stop it. Stop it. I don't like that I'm the only voice in the room. Stop it.
Mortimer is so good. She's done so well.
Oh, come on, you great lunk. I'm the one who sold Robin down the river, profiteering from his capture. Surely you want to strike me dead on the spot. Come on, I can take it. No? Nobody here appreciates the dubious merits of a good strangling?
There was a long silence, broken only by Oberon knocking back more mead and the tiny sloshes as Mortimer turned her whiskey in her glass and dully studied its fiery colours.
The truth is, I didn't know I was being followed, and by the time I realised it, they were surrounding us. My mind must have been elsewhere. There's no chance they could have got the drop on Mortimer Wilson a week ago. But I've come back to see if there's anything I could do, and now we could do. However, I can see you've entirely given up, so I suppose I'm going to have to run this suicide mission all by myself, as per bloody usual.
A fist slammed her face to one side, and Oberon gave a start as he realized they were not alone. Gwendolyn and Viola had entered the hog behind them, and Gwen was now grabbing Mortimer by the scruff of the neck.
You treacherous bitch!
Oh, that's more like it.
I thoroughly enjoy how Mortimer was portrayed, and just, Oberon at times like, yep, okay, no. this is your fight. I'm not carrying this. Here you go. Here's a learning moment for you. Teachable moment.
Just saying everything with a look.
Yeah, and as for Oberon, I have to get this out there just because, honestly, I think it's my single favorite moment, and it was half an ad lib, but it was more Alex's, I would say, brilliant juxtapositioning and editing on this. The part where Oberon and they're talking to the nag, and Oberon just goes, "Wow, wow!" When they're talking about the things, you know, with nag and the was it apples? Or carrots. I can't remember. I can't remember the other horse's name. And Oberon just like, oh, wow.
Oh, God. I didn't know the steed you're talking about.
Yeah. you didn't. Wow. I did. I gave him like four or five different takes. And he used the two, the one that really long and drawn out. Wow. And the wow. Like, I can't believe we're talking about this.
That's lightning in the bottle shit right there. It's just so...
But who else is going to look after the nag?
Send him to stay with us in London.
Not leaving.
I'll fix him up on a romantic tryst with Carrots here.
Had her already.
Is this true, Carrots?
Wow. Wow.
I laughed so... how are you about curse words?
Oh, weird. When I put this thing up on Podbean,
perfect.
When I put this up on Podbean, it was liberally with the explicit tag, because...
Okay, oh man, I should have known that from the beginning, because I curse like there's no friggin', and I say friggin', no fucking get out. oddly enough, I did not swear in front of my son until I was like, I don't know, until he was maybe between 12 and 13, and then the floodgates broke loose, because, you know, he started learning it at school, so I'm like, all right, fair game, here we go.
You didn't hear it from me, it's fine.
Well, we always had the conversation as well, like, okay, if you're going to swear, you have to know the time and the place, what you can and can't say, and there's certain levels of swearing and certain words that you can get away with. But when with that scene, I laughed so fucking hard. I mean, I must have replayed that a good 10 or 15 times and just kept laughing every fucking time I played it, because it was just so inane. I loved it. So, and I've completely taken you off track. I'm sorry.
Honestly, it's fine. There is a format here that allows us to address the ideas that we want to talk about, but nothing could be better than to just have an interview subject that is more than happy to just ramble on and give us brilliant content after content that we wouldn't have necessarily even known to have asked for.
Oh, there's so much hidden stuff. I can't remember which book it was in, but there was a really, really deplorable racist mayor that
God. Yes. Okay. We haven't even talked about him. Okay. I'm editing the episode right now that introduces us to Mayor Buck.
Oh, Buck. That was it.
I'm so sorry,
Alex,
Matt.
Alex,
we have talked so much shit about you on this show.
Alex was pressing me so hard on that character, and I was like, and it was kind of wishy-washy, and then we kind of got into this, goofy thing about enunciation, and if you ever get to talk to Alex before this comes out, next time you talk to him, just start off and go WNBC, and it'll be like, you talk to Matt, what the fuck did he tell you? if you've ever seen the Howard Stern Private Parts movie, him arguing with the station manager of how to properly pronounce the call letters of WNBC, and he'd be like, WNBC, no, WNBC, and we just went back and forth, and he's trying to get me in the right headspace, and then I kept going through it, and I kept fucking it up, and it was getting worse and worse and worse, and then all of a sudden, I just completely fucking unhinged, and I just lose my shit, and I read it, I'm angry, and I'm like, fuck this, fuck that, fuck your lines, fuck this character, F you, this sucks, I don't ever want to do this again, fine, are you happy now, you have it, I'm fucking done, and he's like, perfect, I'm like, okay, great, it took me completely losing my shit, to get this character done, because he's such a scumbag. There's a difference between villains and dickheads, and Buck's a dickhead. And I was like, oh, God damn it. Don't make me do that one again. That one and Miguel's father, another fucking piece of shit. Oh, man, I'm all fired up.
Yeah. Okay, good. Because this leads us perfectly on. As soon as you said earlier, I love playing villains, I was like, interesting, because I just flicked my eye down to one of our questions, which is that as endearing and lovely as Oberon and Jeremy are, you've also played a number of characters who are jerks, assholes, or just downright evil, and the list includes Tremaine, Tommy Sweeney, Mayor Buck, Edison, Miguel's father. There's so many that I suspect you may, if Alex wasn't a contender, you may hold the record for playing the most characters in this category among the cast of New Century.
Do love Edison, though. I do love Edison because he's just a frigging
weasel.
He is. He is a weasel, but he's got that sense of bluster and humor that at least he's getting some of his comeuppances in some ways, which most, I'd say, weasel villains kind of need that. Krieger, now on the other hand, way back when Krieger did, it was, Secret Rooms. I'm like, all right, I'm going to throw a massive fucking curveball in here, and I'm going to make you feel bad for him as much as I could when he's talking about, I had to do this and kill this other person, but with this heaviness in my heart. And I think Alex and Sharon just went, I can't believe you made him sympathetic, in that brief moment. Because as you'll find out later on, it's like, wow, you really kind of are a shithead. But, but I kind of see where you're coming from. Everything's falling apart. So you're like, well, better you come with me, or something to that effect. It's I've lived through all this crap, so it's your turn now. You know,
it's one of those moments where, like, I feel like there should be a better example of this, but, and I also don't like necessarily bringing this up because it just occurred to me that this particular plot line was the brainchild of, now everybody knows shitheel Joss Whedon, but
yeah,
there was a thing during his run of X-Men where it was suddenly revealed that the Danger Room was actually sentient, and Charles knew that, and basically tamped down on their ability to speak for themselves just so he could use the technology, the Danger Room, to train his X-Men, because he felt that was the more important thing than dealing with a new form of sentient life that he had accidentally created.
Yeah.
And that just puts this entire darkness over someone that up till then we associated as being the better of the two when comparing Charles Xavier and Eric Lenscher. So it's you just gotta chill down your spine.
Yeah, it's like, damn.
I have to say, like, can we pause the podcast for a second? Like, Matt, do you have our questions list? Because you keep bringing stuff like
no, okay, no, I do not. I swear you didn't send them to me.
Question six was about Krieger and how it's like, oh, I was going to include him on the list of villains, and then actually he's not. And it's like, what's going on here?
Funny story. It's partially the ADHD and how I connect stuff. Funny story. Completely funny story. When my wife and I were married, she always had trouble buying me birthday presents because I'd in some way, shape, or form figure it out, or at least something close. There was one year, oh God, I will distinctly remember this. I was sitting in my basement. You know, in the house I lived at the time, you'd come straight down the stairs, and right at the bottom of the stairs was my computer desk where I did all my Warhammer painting and everything like that. And as you came out the top of the stairs, it was right by the kitchen, and she was in the kitchen doing something or other. I'm just sitting there painting, mind my own business, and I paint this really dark blue swatch of color on the palette. I look at that and go, that's a really, really nice dark blue. I'm like, man, that's like New York Yankees blue, you know, and put pinstripes on. Hey, you got me Yankees tickets. How the fuck did you know? And I'm like, you know, it's like, yeah.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, one of the beautiful benefits to ADHD is you really make some weird ass connections and predictable stuff, you know, half the time. The other half, you are way fucking wrong. But, yeah.
It's like the thing that I always love bringing back when it comes to being able to make synchronous connections myself. That scene from Into the Spider-Verse. He can do this awesome thing. Do it. I can't do it on command. He can't do it on command.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's like, there are times like, Jen, have you seen my keys? They're in your hand. Oh! Ass.
it's just one of those like weird obtuse superpowers that you will go. I always say this of like that one Adventure Time bit where it's like, hello, Frank the human. How did you almost know my name? I have an approximate knowledge of many things. And that's just my part. It's like, okay, I can't actually guessed the year that this film came out, but you know, I'll be a couple of years out of it. That's fine. I have an approximate knowledge of many things.
You're like Christopher Walken is the mundane psychic or whatnot. He touches someone, is like, you're gonna get an ice cream headache. It's gonna hurt. And that's kind of, I can't remember anything else from that skit, but if you've never seen it, it's fucking wonderful.
And honestly, that's hearing your experience. I don't think I've ever had an issue with the keys specifically, but at least once I've had an occasion where one hand is padding around in my pockets going, oh, did I leave my phone in the car? And I'm staring at Twitter on my phone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you ever look at your watch and then you don't know what time it is? And you have to look again. And you still don't know the time. So you look a third time and somebody says, what time is it? You say, I don't know.
Done that.
Everyone's had the moment of, where the fuck are my glasses? And you're wearing them.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Or they're on top of your, like, you'll tilt them up so they'll rest on your forehead.
Yeah.
But maybe they're so light you don't even remember them.
Yeah, I do that too.
And you always look more ridiculous than you fear, because, like, you can't see yourself. Everyone else can see the glasses. They're right there.
Yeah.
They're right there.
So I'm sorry about spoiling Krieger.
No, it's perfectly okay.
Look, like, we'll just let you answer your own questions before we even ask them. It's fine. We don't have to do anything.
Honestly, when I put this up, it's probably going to be like White Scar's team up number 4. Matt Wardle goes completely off the rails.
Interviews himself. He's like...
We just, like, handed you the box of tracks, and you're just Gromit, just, like, putting them down, like, one after the other.
That's a great reference.
I'm a stop-motion guy, of course I'm going to say that.
All right, so to get back to some semblance of structure here.
Did we ever have it?
No, I don't think we ever did, honestly. But we do have questions we want to ask, and we want to try and ask them in some kind of relevant order.
Sure.
Okay. Now, if you enjoy playing villains, but you've also expressed that some parts of inhabiting that headspace or giving them voice was difficult for you, and you cited Mayor Buck in particular. Where did that difficulty actually come from? Was it in actually just using the words that they use? Or how does that work for you on a mental level when you're inhabiting a character like that?
Yeah, Buck specifically with the wording. That was really unpleasant. to me, it's weird. A good villain, to me... When I say good villain, I mean one that I'm more happier to play, has to have some sort of resonance or connection where you question yourself just for a minute and go, well, I kind of see what they're getting at. And then you have to go, well, yeah, but there's all that other bad shit. but there has to be something there that you can kind of latch onto and go, okay, well, maybe I can... you know, connect with this person a little bit and see, even though that they're really kind of messed up and really, you know, deviant slash evil slash, you know, reprehensible, that you can still feel there's slightly redeemable quality. I don't know. But yeah, someone like Buck or, you know, Miguel's father, who's Francisco. I can't remember his
Francisco,
name.
Francisco. Yeah. His name.
Yeah. Just, you're just like, you are just disgusting on every single level, and there's nothing there that, you know, is worthwhile, you know, latching onto, unless you're specifically setting that person up to just get wrecked in, you know, the most come-upable way. And that's something I think I need to get over a little bit and just go, all right, it's just, you know, a character, and you know, that's part of the thing is I guess you really want to make them, you know, unlikable on any level. But yeah, Buck was, I think Buck was harder than Francisco even. And, you know, even though I've got a son that I'm just like, this was really uncomfortable, you know, for me to, you know, treat my son as a commodity and, you know, don't make too much noise. Don't do this, you know, because I got some stuff going on over here. You know, you're cramping my style. Shoo, kid, you bother me. You know, you know, and that's just like, you know, just dripping with gross. Yeah, exactly. And doing someone of, you know, Francisco's descent was actually a little hard for me. Sometimes I don't always do great with accents as well as I would like to.
You say that, but yeah. When I was going through the list of all the characters you played, like some of these roles, even whether small or large, I don't think I knew that. Oh, I mean, there's a similar accent that you're using, I think, for both Krieger and Julius Kaufman in the Cartographer's Handbook.
I love Kaufman.
Oh, he's so good. I was listening to his chapter today.
but you disappear into a lot of accents. And, I mean, the same thing can happen with Alex sometimes. Sometimes you can tell it's his voice, and sometimes you just have no clue, and you only find out after the fact. But whether it's just you manage to find the right combination of stuff that just makes your own personality. Like, just listening to you talk right now, I would have never have thought that you were the same person that played the very sort of refined Mr. Galloway and Let Them Go and everything.
Oh, like, yeah, that. Yeah, Mr. Galloway.
And that even wasn't necessarily a heavy accent. It was just a far different, slow, measured mannerism that so far, I wouldn't want to say seem incapable of doing, but it's very atypical.
Well, I take that as immense praise, because in my head sometimes I'm like, oh, it's just Matt with a bad accent, or it's just Matt talking a little lower, or I think, you know, part of it actually comes from public speaking classes and the voice acting classes, because I grew up on the East Coast of the U.S. in New York, not New York City, but upstate. But even as such, you know, Eastern Americans, you know, especially in the Northeast, talk fast, think fast, walk fast. You know, everything's da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It's something that I have to consciously think about when I'm doing a voice that needs to be more slower or measured or enunciate more, and kind of go back to those days and go, okay, you know, one of the, you know, classes, you know, I had to take, we had to read this, you know, poem, and you know, it's like Lackawanna, rolling full and loose, and you're just like, okay, I gotta over enunciate these words and make sure I'm not blending them all into one thing and blah blah blah, which my son does, and I'm trying to, you know, keep him like, Scott, you seriously am, slow down, you're killing me Smalls.
I have never seen that movie, and yet I know that line by heart.
Yeah, but I'm amazed when people go, oh my gosh, I couldn't hear that was you. And that always blows my mind, because it sits in the back of my head that, you know, I hear it in my head. And then when it plays back, I'm going, oh, maybe I guess I could see it. You know, I don't like to say, wow, I'm really good at this. One thing I'm lucky to have is I can get an extremely good range on my voice, so I can bring it down lower and it can go way higher like that. You know, so it's like, you know, it allows me to do a lot of weird stuff that, you know, people's like, you know, what's going on? I don't know. I don't want to hear it. You know, it's like blah, blah, blah. Finding those parts where you go, okay, you know, it sounds a little bit like me, but it doesn't sound like me, you know, kind of like, when you go, you know, wait, who does what on The Simpsons? Like Castellaneta does this voice too? Holy crap, I never would have thought that, you know. So when someone says, I had no idea that was you, that's about the best thing I think anybody can, you know, give me as praise. And honestly, that's just about made my day.
So, I mean, Matt, I put together this list. I forgot you were Mr. Galloway. Like, I was like, oh shit, yeah. Wait, I typed that.
No, I think part of the issue that we can have with putting on a voice, particularly if we're trying to be imitated from someone else. And this is just one of those weird physics things, is that when we're hearing our own voice through our ears,
yeah,
it comes out differently, which is part of the reason why it took me so long to even do something like a podcast, because every time I heard my voice recorded through a device, it always sounded worse to me, and I was just like, I'm not showing this to anyone ever.
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, absolutely. I know that feeling.
Here I went off on a bit of a tangent in regards to performing a specific character that most people know and love, Inigo Montoya from The Princess Bride, as a part of a bit for friends to enjoy. The Princess Bride is one of those movies that everyone loves to memorize, but I had always tried to go a step farther, imitating the vocal cadences as well. And as someone that had Mexican extended family, I'd always felt that I had a good comprehension of the accent. However, it's actually shocking how difficult it is to pronounce certain words accent that is not your natural accent. Like, you can do a general approximation of it. When I was actually listening to myself back with that, I realized that I was stumbling over these words, and therefore it had some degree of, like, I had to go back in and be like, okay, how do you pronounce this in that accent? Otherwise, it's just going to sound ridiculous. Mm.
But you got to leave a certain amount of that in, because if you sort of polish something too much, it becomes too refined and how normal people will stumble across certain words.
And it takes you a little bit out of the element, going, oh, okay, well, that was perfect, and you're like, wait, but yeah, everything else is, you know, kind of theatricized, and you're like, oh, that doesn't sound right. You know,
I was thinking about this just during our conversation, that if, like, we spend our whole lives just shaping the way we talk, the way we, like, act, just in different circles. We're, like, sculpting ourselves out of clay, and, like, the longer you spend with that, the more hardened you are. And to kind of, like, try and break that down and reshape it into a different shape is something that, like, I would love to try my hand at, but it's just really conceptually a difficult thing. And obviously, like, plenty enough people seem to have a handle on it, but it will never stop being just conceptually an impressive feat to me. And I think everyone on New Century definitely deserves many rounds of applause, and obviously that goes without saying, but anyway, I will say
it's wild. Like, I've been dabbling very lightly, and like I was doing it for a couple weeks, and then on and off, and I got to kind of get back into it. Like, I was starting to dabble with learning Mandarin. Oh my goodness. You know, it's like the difference between, you know, and Scott, you know, my son, that's my son, asking me, you know, so what's the difference? I'm like, well, it's really kind of a tonal language. So even though something's kind of written the same, there's a difference between she and she. And he's like, but I'm like, yeah, the other one's just slightly more forward in the mouth. And you're like, what's that sound like? I'm like, well, it sounds like that. You know, it's like, ooh, and I'm looking at this going, oh my God, this is rough. But, you know, language and accents absolutely fascinate me. So.
And that's where we'll end it for this week. As amazing as the interview was, it took me way too long to make progress with it. Some of it was my editor brain, as I'll get to in a second, but some of it was also just having more to do at work, as well as getting more nervous as we get closer to election day. I am not going to promise more interview and more secret rooms for next week, because I thought I was going to get a lot of editing done this week and utterly failed on that score. So we'll just see how things go. In the meantime, I spent way too long pondering what music to use for the outro today. I wanted something strong and momentous to go with Talk of Oberon, or something from my past that was hugely funny to go with the energy of Matt. Originally, I pondered ending with Under Pressure by Bowie and Queen, but there's no way I'd be able to top the music video that Alex already made for that bit. And honestly, with all the negative energy that I'm already dealing with, I wanted something light and fluffy to close us out. So here's a piece that came to mind purely due to talk of the Princess Thieves. The artists Paul and Storm originally wrote this merely to perform for an audience, but I first saw it because someone used World of Warcraft to make their own video to go with it, which I'll link to in the doobly-doo. I give you The Captain's Wife's Lament.
The ship sailed into harbor after 15 months at sea. The captain hit the tavern with his crew of 53. After drinking up their pay, they staggered through the town. But all the inns and public houses turned the sailors down. The captain said, "Fear not, me lads, you all can come with me. I live just round the corner, and you all can stay for free." But when the captain's wife awoke upon the break of day, they say that you could hear her wailing clear to Botany Bay.
Arr!
She said, "There's semen all around the bed and semen on the floor. Semen in the bathroom and behind the closet door. There's semen in the fireplace and semen in the hall. The living room is carpeted with semen wall to wall. There's semen in the entryway and semen on the stair. And worst of all, there's even semen in me underwear. There's some behind the larder and beneath the table too. I do believe your semen got into me Irish stew. There's semen here in front of me and semen in the rear. My God, there's even semen hanging from the chandelier. There's semen on the windowsill and semen in the yard. The semen even left a stain upon the Saint Bernard. Although I am a patient wife, 'tis more than I can bear to wake up in the morning with your semen in my hair. I ne'er again do wish to see thee darken up my door. So clean up all your semen and come round my way no more. So clean up all your semen and come round.